From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the mystery of Arafat. We talk with Israeli journalist Danny Rubenstein about how Yasser Arafat created his public image as the symbol of Palestinians. Rubenstein has covered Arab and Palestinian affairs for close to 30 years and is the author of a new book about Arafat. Also today, writing and snake handling. We talk with Tim McLaurin, author of the novel Cured by Fire. And music critic Milo Miles reviews Solomon Burke's new CD, Live at the House of Blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. UN officials now say the Bosnian enclave of Srebrenica has fallen to Bosnian Serb forces. The action comes after NATO warplanes successfully carried out airstrikes against Serbian tanks that were threatening Dutch peacekeeping forces in the Srebrenica area. Michael Connor reports.
Until today, the town of Srebrenica and the area around it was one of six government-controlled enclaves which were supposed to be protected by the United Nations. Its fall means the United Nations has suffered one of its greatest humiliations in Bosnia. And what it means to the 30 to 45,000 Muslim refugees who live there won't be known for at least a few hours. Like the other enclaves, Srebrenica was surrounded by Serb forces. They have been shelling it for many months. And late last week, they began to move in ground troops and tanks. In response, the small contingent of Dutch peacekeepers tried to at least block the tanks. And earlier today, NATO airplanes attacked Serb forces threatening the Dutch. Even so, the Dutch, vastly outnumbered, could only withdraw to their base camp, and the Serb soldiers advanced into the town. For National Public Radio, this is Mike O'Connor in Sarajevo.
Meanwhile, Bosnian Serbs say they have established a new Serbian civilian government over the eastern enclave of Srebrenica. Bosnian Serb television is reporting a Serbian mayor has been appointed to run the newly liberated town. Up until today, it had tens of thousands of mostly Muslim residents. French President Jacques Chirac says France is prepared to intervene militarily if asked to by the United Nations to retake Srebrenica. Other Muslim enclaves in eastern Bosnia have been subject in recent days to the same kind of shelling as Srebrenica was subject to. A judge in Union, South Carolina, has ruled that Susan Smith is sane and will stand trial for the murder of her two sons. Suzanne Stevens of member station WFAE reports from Union.
A judge ruled today that Susan Smith is competent to stand trial. Last October, she confessed to rolling her car into a lake with 3-year-old Michael and 14-month-old Alex Smith strapped inside. Before making his ruling, the judge quizzed Smith about the charges. Smith said she understood the roles of the judge and prosecutor in the case and understood she was facing the death penalty. Smith, who's taking an antidepressant, was composed and answered all the judge's questions clearly. Jury selection has begun and could last through next week. For National Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Stevens in Union, South Carolina.
President Clinton has announced the normalization of relations with Vietnam. Mr. Clinton says any improvement in relations between the United States and Vietnam had depended on Hanoi's progress in accounting for missing American servicemen. Mr. Clinton says Vietnam has taken important steps on the MIA issue. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen nearly 26 points to 4,676. Trading is very heavy. This is NPR. Greenpeace demonstrators protesting French nuclear testing have disrupted the start of talks between the French president and German chancellor and the German chancellor in Strasbourg, France. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
Members of Greenpeace protested near the European Parliament in Strasbourg shortly before French President Jacques Chirac addressed the assembly. In his speech, Chirac did not mention the controversial French plans to test nuclear bombs in the South Pacific, but he was loudly booed by members of left-wing parties throughout his speech. Dozens of delegates held up signs with a large no written inside of the mushroom cloud of a nuclear explosion. French police later forcefully broke up a Greenpeace demonstration in the city's center. The environmentalists also rented a dirigible that flew over the city, dangling a banner that said, "Stop nuclear testing." German Chancellor Helmut Kohl says he will discuss the issue during his talks with Chirac. There is growing protest in Germany across the political spectrum to the French nuclear tests. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
The United Nations Population Fund says the rest of the decade could be crucial in setting the quality of life for the next century. The group's annual report was released today. It says there's been progress on its recommendations for action to slow down population growth. The plan was adopted last September at the UN's Population Conference in Cairo. The Cairo Program of Action calls for $17 billion to be spent each year on population control by the year 2000. Japan is rather dizzy over the prospects of baseball pitcher Hideo Nomo. He has been selected to be the starting pitcher for the National League in tonight's All-Star Game. Sports newspapers are shouting the news in banner headlines and giant photos of Nomo. Japan's prime minister sent Nomo a pep talk via fax machine. The LA Dodgers pitcher is the first Japanese ball player to make the U.S. major leagues in 30 years. He's the first ever to play in the All-Star Game. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Danny Rubenstein is an Israeli journalist who has written the name Yasser Arafat almost every day for the last 28 years. Yet, Rubenstein has remained bewildered by Arafat's enigmatic personality. In fact, Rubenstein has found in his meetings with Arabs, Israelis, and Americans that whether they speak of Arafat with appreciation or disgust, most are perplexed by the phenomenon of Arafat. In the new book, The Mystery of Arafat, Rubenstein examines Arafat's carefully constructed image. Rubenstein says he's focused on image because Arafat's principal role has been to serve as a symbol of the Palestinian people. Danny Rubenstein is a columnist for the Hebrew daily paper Haaretz. He's been covering Arab and Palestinian affairs since 1967. In 1988, he received the Sokolow Prize, Israel's equivalent of the Pulitzer. His previous book, The People of Nowhere, was about the Palestinian vision of homeland. I asked Rubenstein what he finds mysterious or confusing about Arafat.
He doesn't have a private life at all. Since he began his political activity in the 50s, he's all 24 hours a day he dedicates to his people. And he doesn't have any private life. Only recently he was married, but he never had a home. He never had. He never did the usual things that every one of us does. He didn't go to movies, to theater. He didn't watch sport. He didn't listen to music. He didn't do anything besides political activity. It was all his life. And then there were a lot of paradoxical, spots in his behavior. On one hand, he got a success, which is really something, I would say, incredible. He took a bunch of vagabonds in the 60s, and he crystallized them to a national movement. And he coped with Israel, with us. And now he's negotiating with the government of Israel, with my country, about the partition of sovereignty over the land of what we call Eretz Israel or Palestine, which is really a success. On the other hand, people don't trust him. Arab leaders don't trust him. Sometimes his own people call him a liar, a terrorist. And I'll give you one example. When he first came to Gaza about a year ago, the first Israeli that he met was a rabbi called Moshe Hirsch, who is even not a clown in Israel. He's an ultra, ultra Orthodox Jew who doesn't represent anybody. And he gave him a title of a member of the Palestinian cabinet in charge of Jewish affairs, which is I don't know how to call it. It's not even a joke. But he did it.
Yasser Arafat has been a symbol of the Palestinians and of the Palestinians' statelessness. And although he used to say he was born in Palestine, he was actually born and raised in Cairo, Egypt. How long did he tell people that he was actually born and raised in Palestine?
Up to today, if you'll call his office in Gaza, And you'll ask the people there or his spokesman where Arafat was born. They'll tell you that he was born in Jerusalem. Because nativity was one of the major Palestinian arguments in the dispute between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So for a Palestinian symbol, or for Mr. Palestine, the fact that he was not born in Palestine was something very embarrassed.
Why are biographers and journalists confident that he was really born and raised in Egypt?
Because there are all people found all the documents. All the documents of he's born in Cairo, he's going to school there, and he's raising. And you know what? The main fact is that he has, up till now, he has an Egyptian accent. And people can identify his accent for, you know, once he opened his mouth, so you can hear that he's not a Palestinian, that he was born, that, you know, that he's not native Palestinian, that he was born in Cairo, because he used an Egyptian accent and not a Palestinian accent. And he probably cannot get rid of this accent.
Israeli journalist Danny Rubenstein is my guest. His new book is called The Mystery of Arafat. And he's been writing about Palestinian affairs since the late 1960s. You say that Arafat has tried to blot out his identity as a private person and create a new image for himself. And that image included the army uniform, the revolver at his side, the keffiyeh or headdress, his unshaven face. How important do you think that aspect of his image has been? The physical aspect of that image.
In this case, I think that I'll put it this way. You know that I read hundreds of interviews that were done with him. During the 70s and the 80s, you know that almost everyone, every journalist, every politician who met him in the 70s came to him and started to talk to him about, you know, about terrorism, about Palestinian state, about Israel and so on. But then he stopped and said, but I have to ask you something. Why don't you shave? There are tens of answers.
What are some of them?
Because he tried to wipe out his personal, his private image, his answers will be always nationalistic answers. He will never say something like, I have a skin problem, because it's too individual, it's too personal. He would say something like, most of my life I've been in the caves on the mountains, there were no facilities there for shaving and so on. Or another answer that he will give that that he gave those years is that for shaving, it takes you, every man, the average will be 5 minutes a day, and he multiplied it, you know how long it's, I don't know, a couple of hours a week and in a month and so on. And then his conclusion would be that it takes every man about half a year or more that in his life that he spend shaving. And he cannot afford to spend this time, you know, it's a waste of time for him, not for him personally, but for Palestinian people, to spend time shaving and looking nice and spoiling themselves. He doesn't have the time, he cannot afford to do it.
Well, what have the biggest controversies within the PLO been over Arafat's leadership?
I would say the fact that he ran his movement as a one-man show. And people don't like it. People don't like it. Today in Gaza, you know that a few months ago there were some rumors or some complaints in Gaza that there is corruption in the telephone system in his new administration. So he issued an order that from now on he's the only one everybody who need a telephone have to go to Arafat and need his personal signature. So try to imagine that he run, you know, a movement, a country, in the future they want to establish a state, and he sign for telephone applications. And it's not only telephone; it's all the budget of the movement, of the PLO, all the decisions are taken only by him. And I don't know what will be if one day he will, he will gone.
When He became active in negotiations during the peace process. Was there any kind of campaign on the part of the Israeli government to change his image and make him more palatable to Israelis after so many years of being of his image being the intractable terrorist to Israelis? I mean, that's the image Israelis had of him.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But the government, the Labour government, the current government in Israel, tried to convince the people that there is no alternative. Because he is, as I said, it's a one-man show, so we have to talk to him. At the beginning of the talks after Madrid, we talked to his people from the occupied territories, to the delegation, Palestinian delegation from Gaza and from the Western Bank. But they saw that they cannot say and they cannot decide anything. They run for and they call Arafat every 5 minutes. So it was useless. They decided, let's talk to the man who got all the power in his hand, all the all the influence. And he's the only one who take decisions. So what the government did is not really a campaign, but they told the people, listen, we have to talk to the man and write to him and not to bypass and not to try to play games.
My guest is Israeli journalist Danny Rubenstein, author of the new book, The Mystery of Arafat. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Israeli journalist Danny Rubenstein, author of the new book, The Mystery of Arafat. In his new role as the head of the Palestinian Authority, he's been accused of having an autocratic style and of being very inefficient as an administrator. Would you agree with those criticisms?
Yes, he's very inefficient because he wants to do everything by himself. As I gave you the example of signing the telephone applications,
mm-hmm.
and you know that about 3 or 4 weeks ago, one friend of mine, a Palestinian, had an appointment with him, and wait outside his office for 2 hours for the meeting, and then he was quite upset. And when he got into the office, he tried to find out why he was waiting, why it was this delay of 2 hours. And he find out that that Arafat was busy checking all the traffic tickets in Gaza in the last I would say months or so, because there were some complaints that the police officers took the money from the fines and didn't give it to the police authority. So Arafat decided to check all the traffic tickets of Gaza. He does everything. He ran the budget, he ran the, you know, it's, as I said, it's one-man show. It was during the revolution, and it's now during the establishing of the Palestinian bureaucracy and administration. And it's, I would say it's impossible. Maybe for a revolutionary movement, he could do it. But now, I don't know, maybe his time is over.
Well, do you think it is over? Is there a rebellion among his own people against him?
I don't know if it would be a rebellion, but it doesn't go smoothly this way. They need a different person now. At the 60s and 70s, when the main, I would say, target or the main problem for the Palestinian people was to bring their issue to the public opinion in the world, in the Arab states, and so on, he was very, very efficient. But now he doesn't need, for instance, this military uniform. They need a guy with a gray suit, with you know that with tie and who's who knows to run, you know, to create administrations and money, and not a guy that was very good in public relations, but not good as a bureaucracy.
Is he still wearing the military uniform?
Yeah, he still. He never. I don't think that he'll never take it out. You know, he'll never. He'll have the uniform. That's his symbol. That's Arafat. It's the uniform. It's the unshaved face. The keffiyeh on his head. Everything represent the movement, Palestine, and so on.
His police are cracking down on Hamas, the militant Islamic fundamentalist group that has been in competition with the PLO. And the Israeli government has, I think, made it clear that it's going to measure his credibility based on his ability to crack down on fundamentalists and to crack down against violence toward Israeli settlers. Is he considered an Israeli pawn now?
For some of his opponents within the Palestinian camp, the answer is yes. Sometimes they call him, like, you know, that Israel has a militia in South Lebanon of, I don't know how to call them, collaborators, or people accuse them of being collaborators. So they said, the Israeli used him, as you said, as a pawn or something, but the accusation, I don't know if a lot of people really agree with it among the Palestinians. According to the polls, he still have a very large support, which reach, I would say, 60-70%. He doesn't have any competition.
What do you think it's been like for Arafat and for other people in the Palestinian Authority to crack down on fellow Muslims, fellow Palestinians, even though the people who they're cracking down against are in opposition to the Palestinian Authority? But still, it's this kind of policing your own, a position that they'd never been in before. They could always attribute the policing and crackdowns and so on to them, to their enemy, to Israel.
Arafat is not a cruel leader. He's not, as I said, Saddam Hussein, and he's not even President Assad. He's much more, I would say, mild or soft Arab leader. I would say something like King Hussein or President Mubarak, who, to a certain extent, respect other people's rights and opposition. And he does it, I think he deals with the Hamas in a very clever and wise way. Because if he would really crash them, he'll got the opposition, you know, will be stronger. He does it in, I don't know how what term to use, in some gentle way, or, you know, relatively speaking. If it, stuff like this, the way he treats them, will happen in this country, there'll be here, I don't know, chaos. But according to the Middle Eastern, I would say, values, it's okay he doesn't kill people. He arrests people in some martial courts for short terms. But he will never cross the red line, you know, of being. That's my conclusion. He'll never cross the red line of, you know, being a real despot.
You described Arafat as mild and soft as a leader, and I think that's going to astound a lot of our listeners who think of him as, for years, being the world's most famous terrorist.
Well, you know, there are. I would agree that. That many years he used terrorism, of course, no doubt about it. Although he will never admit it. But you know, I want that the listeners will take it in because, as I say, I compare him to third world leaders, and I compare him to Saddam Hussein or to Muammar Gaddafi of Libya and such leaders. I cannot compare them to, I don't know, to European, Western European or American leaders, because it's not the same social structure.
So tell me what your personal assessment is of Yasser Arafat. Do you trust him? Do you trust him as the representative in the peace process? Do you think he's helping the peace process or holding it back?
He's progressing the peace process right now. About trust, that's very complicated because, you see, personally, I wouldn't trust him. And I think that also the Israeli government and the Arab leaders, they don't trust him. And they, when they sign an agreement with him, they want to put, you know, barriers and to put conditions and to put control that would make sure that he will keep it. When he doesn't keep his promises or his agreements, it's not because he doesn't want to do it, because he cannot do it sometimes. And now all the complications about the new agreement with the Palestinians is because of this, because Israelis and others don't trust him, that he can change his mind, that he can, ignore items that he promised and that he signed. For instance, the problem with the Palestinian covenant that he promised to change it, and he didn't do it. But there are many, many other items.
Did he ever lie to you?
No, I saw him several times, but I have only one time, a very long, I think 5 or 6 hours conversation with him, interview with him. And he didn't lie, but he gave such interpretation of reality, which is ridiculous sometimes. Only recently he said that one of the terrorist activity against Israel was done by the Israeli army as a provocation. Or he even said it not to me, he said it to Rabin, and Rabin really was so upset that that there was an explosion there, and the meeting was canceled. But and he can do such a thing. And when people cannot, he argue all the time. It's not when you interview him, it's not answer question, it's argument all the time. He argue and argue and argue. I, for instance, asked him in my interview with him, why did you support Saddam Hussein? And he looking at me and gave me such a naive look and said, I support Saddam Hussein? It's not, I didn't support him. And I was so surprised because it was all the words. So the photograph, the pictures and television show how he hugged Saddam Hussein only a few days before the war, and all of a sudden he denied and said, I didn't support him at all. I only tried to prevent this catastrophic war and so on. And he started to give some justification of his being in good relation. But first of all, he denied and said, it's a lie, I didn't support him, and so on. So we argue all the time, and which is very... So you ask me if he lies to me. No, but I don't know if it's a lie or not a lie, but he argue all the time, and he tries so polemic. And it's simply you cannot have really a real interview with him.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Danny Rubenstein is the author of The Mystery of Arafat. Rubenstein is a columnist for the Israeli paper Haaretz. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
All right, here we go. The king of soul and rock and roll, Mr. Solomon Burke.
Coming up, music critic Milo Miles reviews Solomon Burke's new CD, Live at the House of Blues. Also, writing, snake handling, and recovering from cancer. We talk with writer Tim McLaren, author of the novel Cured by Fire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations is trying to get Bosnian Serbs to agree to a ceasefire in Srebrenica. The Bosnian Serb army overran the UN-declared safe area despite a NATO airstrike that hit one of their tanks. It's the first of the six safe areas to fall. A senior Pentagon official speaking on background says the fall of Srebrenica is a terrible breach of the safe havens concept. Meanwhile, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was on Capitol Hill today to answer questions about the last set of airstrikes, which resulted in the downing of a U.S. pilot over Serbian-held Bosnia. He also talked about lessons learned from the June incident. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
General John Shalikashvili told members of the House National Security Committee that minutes before the shootdown of Captain Scott O'Grady, reports were received that his plane was being targeted by Serb forces. Unfortunately, that message was garbled and valuable warning time was lost.
As you can hear, the message was clearly so garbled that it could not be understood, had to be repeated. The clear transmission did not arrive till after the aircraft had been shot down.
The general says improvements are being made in the system for reporting such threats, and the Pentagon has begun handing out 500 advanced radios to pilots to make it easier to communicate if they are shot down. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
An Italian judge has issued an international arrest warrant for former socialist Prime Minister Bettino Craxi on charges of corruption. NPR Silvio Poggioli reports from Rome.
Bettino Craxi, who was prime minister from 1984 to 1987, is currently living in exile in Tunisia. He is involved in 20 separate corruption investigations and was tried in his absence and sentenced to 8.5 years in prison in another corruption case. The international arrest warrant is linked to an investigation concerning kickbacks in the construction of the Milan subway. Craxi, once one of Italy's most powerful politicians, is also one of the country's most prominent casualties of 3 years of corruption investigations. At the height of his power, he addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress and was appointed special envoy for North-South relations by then U.N. Secretary General Perez de Cuellar. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
Officials at a long-distance telephone company in Raleigh, North Carolina, say they have no idea why a mail bomb would be sent to one of their executives. The mail bomb was mailed yesterday to a department store manager at the BTI telephone company. She remains in serious condition with injuries to her hand and torso. A colleague was slightly injured, treated and released from the hospital. Stock prices fell sharply on Wall Street today. The Dow lost 22 points to close at 4,680. Declines led advances by a margin of more than 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. In Cairo, the Arab League has turned down a request from Sudan to mediate its continuing dispute with Egypt. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Secretary General Esmat Abdel-Magid said that Sudan and Egypt should try to solve their problems bilaterally before seeking help from the Arab League. Relations between the two neighbors have been strained following an assassination attempt on Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Egypt has accused Sudan of involvement in the plot. Sudan has denied the charges, but one Sudanese leader recently praised the attackers. Meanwhile, Egypt said that all Sudanese nationals would have to apply for entry visas valid for only a month. The measure could affect more than 3 million Sudanese, many of them refugees, believed to be currently living in Egypt. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
China says human rights activist Harry Wu is guilty of spying, but a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman says the charges against the Chinese American are still being investigated. He added that the decision on whether to make Wu's trial public or private will depend on what kinds of government secrets he's eventually accused of stealing. Wu was formally charged Saturday with espionage and taking state secrets. Both crimes are punishable by death. A federal task force says landlords shouldn't always be held legally responsible when their tenants suffer from lead poisoning. A 39-member task force says landlords who follow basic guidelines to protect young tenants from lead exposure should be given some protection from lawsuits. But the report has been denounced as morally repugnant by four members of the task force. The four say the panel was dominated by the interests of landlords, insurance companies, and government officials. The task force issued recommendations like warning tenants about the dangers of lead, prompt repair of deteriorated paint, and more federal dollars to clean up leaded paint. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tim McLaurin's first career after he left the Marines was as a Pepsi salesman. His second was as a snake handler with a traveling carnival. Then he was a Peace Corps volunteer in Tunisia, and when he returned to the States, he started to write fiction. His writing was interrupted by bone marrow cancer, which he thinks has been cured by a bone marrow transplant. McLaurin wrote about growing up in the rural South in his memoir, Keeper of the Moon. In his new novel, Cured by Fire, he writes about two men, one a successful professional, the other a migrant worker. Both lose everything they love in fire, and their lives are transformed in unexpected ways. Here's a short reading about Lewis, the professional, who accidentally sets the house on fire after he falls asleep drunk with a lit cigarette.
Lewis lifted his face from water. He looked at the vomit in the toilet, shuddered, and puked up more red liquid. He wiped his mouth with his hand, then lifted his bottle and gagged down more liquor. Lurching into the bedroom, he raised the bottle like a trumpet. He took another cigarette from the pack, lit it, and drew heavily before flopping down on the mattress. Morning now lit the ceiling. The stars he had wandered through had been turned off. The bed was spinning, boring through the floorboards and concrete foundations into the earth. Lewis tasted dirt and worms. He first smelled the smoke, acrid and nasty, then heard the crackle of flames. Where once the sky had stretched above him, he looked into dancing fire. So be it, he thought, I deserve hell. He spat towards the flames. The heat mounted quickly and encircled him just as the vines had done in the garden. Orange and yellow tendrils burned him, and he laughed and howled and cursed as he became one with fire.
Now, I know before writing this novel, you had cancer. Is there a parallel between the significance of that in your life and the significance of the fire in the lives of your characters?
Well, so certainly this novel comes closer to my life than the previous books. I mean, I certainly believe that fiction mimics and follows the life of the writer, but this book more closely in that, as you said, I 6 years ago was diagnosed with bone marrow cancer or multiple myeloma, and the ultimate treatment that I received was a bone marrow transplant at the VA hospital in Seattle. And this process involving intense chemotherapy is basically like flames itself. They virtually take you as close to death as possible, burn out the disease inside of you with drugs, and then hopefully you recover and come back up from the the damage and lead or walk forward into life. So in a lot of ways, it parallels the title of this book, Cured by Fire, because my experience was very similar to fire.
When you had your bone marrow transplant, the bone marrow came from your younger brother. And because he was compatible with you, the marrow was compatible with yours. I can't imagine what it was like to be in the position of having to ask him to make that sacrifice. I believe it's a very painful process for the donor, and it took about 3 months of his life to go through that process with you. Was that really hard to ask of him?
Well, certainly Bruce is one of my heroes, but also it was not hard for me to ask this of him or of any other member of the family, because I knew in my own heart that I would without hesitation do the same for any of my siblings or any other person for that matter. So when they were called upon to come and give blood to see who would, if anyone would match me, they all came without hesitation. I have three brothers and two sisters, and Bruce happened to be the one who matched me. Ironically, growing up, we all shared one bedroom, and Bruce and I slept in the same bed together, and so I think it's sort of strange that we would share the same covers and share also very similar bone marrow.
In one of your previous books, a memoir called Keeper of the Moon, you reprint a letter that your brother left for you at the end of the treatment. And I'd like to read an excerpt of that letter. He wrote, "Tim, I'm not much for expressing my feelings. I just wanted to tell you that I'm glad that I was the one to match with you and was able to give you my marrow. I would also give you my heart if it would help. The time I spent out here gave us a chance to be together as brothers should. I will always cherish this time we had and hope we can stay close and not drift apart as we have in years past."
That's right. And Terry, I'm holding that original letter in my hand right now. I carry it in my wallet as sort of a good luck charm. It's gotten wet a few times when I went swimming and got to take my wallet, or fishing, and not take my wallet out of my pants, but I have the original letter.
My guest is Tim McLaurin. His latest novel is called Cured by Fire. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Tim McLaurin. He used to be a snake handler with a carnival. I asked him how he started handling snakes and what pleasure it gave him.
Well, the first snake I caught was early in life. I was about six, I guess. I had been taught, like everyone else, to hack snakes into little pieces and that they could do incredible feats that no other animal on earth could do, like chase down horses and roll in a hoop and all these things you hear. And for whatever reason, I saw this snake. I knew it was a green snake. It was not poisonous. I caught it, carried it home, put it in a jar, and then I did something next that was very important. I went to the library and got a book on snakes and started reading. And as I read about snakes, I began to realize that all these things I had been told to believe about reptiles mostly were untrue. And that started me also sort of the seed towards questioning other parts of life. One, that if I didn't want to live in Fayetteville, North Carolina all my life, work a blue-collar job, 9 to 5, go to live and die in the same part of town, if I did not want that life, I didn't necessarily have to. And so I think snakes were very instrumental in opening up the world to me, to making me first go to books and then see that the world is a very different place. And also part of, I guess, my interest in snakes is it's different. It's something other people, most people don't handle poisonous reptiles. But I do have a big interest and fascination in holding a rattlesnake and milking its venom into a glass. And just like some people like to collect stamps.
What do you do with the venom after you've milked it?
Well, back in the old days during the snake shows, I used to drink it as part of my carnival act. I would I'd milk a big rattlesnake into a glass, and then I'd turn up the old few drops of venom and swallow it just to show that it would not hurt you in any way.
Is that true? It only affects you if it's directly into your bloodstream?
Yes, from pit vipers, from hemotoxic venom. You could drink, I mean, I've drank probably a pint of it altogether in my life, and no, it's very quickly neutralized by your stomach juices, by your saliva. Now, if you were to milk a snake into a glass and then draw it up into a syringe and run it into your arm, it would be just like the snake biting you.
What does it taste like?
Well, sort of tasteless. I don't know, sort of a cross between orange juice and tequila, maybe.
Well, I know when you were in your mid-20s, this was in 1977, you quit a job, I believe, as a salesman for Pepsi, to travel with a carnival as Wild Man Mac, the last great snake show. What was your show?
Well, I like to look at it as the last great snake show. I've, since childhood, have been very disillusioned and disappointed by carnival snake shows where you go inside and you see maybe a one big python sitting there, and maybe there's a box with a man sitting there who's supposed to be the snake man from Borneo or whatever, And in reality, he's sitting there with two or three non-poisonous snakes reading a magazine or something. So my show was the real thing. I had cobras, I had coral snakes, rattlers, big pythons. I milked snakes in front of people. I would let kids hold snakes. And the main thrust of the program was not to just be a freak show, but it was to educate people. You know, part of my reason for being there was to show people that snakes are not what we think they are, that they're creatures of the earth like squirrels and birds. Of course, it didn't hurt that I had much more hair at that time. I had long hair and a beard and would draw people in by holding a big rattlesnake and milking it and drinking the venom. I'd get them in the tent and I'd get their quarters, and then hopefully they would leave with a better understanding of reptiles in general.
What would the barker say to get people into your tent?
Oh, there. It depended on the program. There would be somebody out front saying, live before you, direct from the Amazon, Wild Man Mac, Last Great Snake Show, some similar monologue. But a lot of the times I would just stand in the doorway of the tent and with maybe a boa constrictor wrapped around my neck or something, and that in itself would draw people. They'd come up and start talking, and then I'd say, well, come on inside and see what I have here. And so I generally would have a pretty good flow of people. Even today, I still do reptile programs at schools occasionally for civic organizations. It's something that I'll probably do until I run out of snakes or run out of fingers to hold them with.
In your memoir about your Southern boyhood, you wrote, "We were Southern working-class men expected to hammer out a paycheck, produce children, and hold our liquor. Anything less was a failure." Did handling snakes fit into what your early concept was of what it meant to be a man?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question, because I think a lot of my life growing up, those very requirements that you just read of being a Southern man scared me, particularly hammering out a paycheck, because the paychecks that I saw hammered out by my father and most men were strictly for the money earned and by the sweat of their brow. So in some ways, snakes were an escape from that. Most men didn't handle snakes. I remember my father did not like snakes. He was not terrified of them, but he would kill most snakes that he encountered. And so I think early on, I was trying to escape sort of that role that I saw presented to me, that label that defined what is a Southern man. And snakes were a vehicle. It was something curious to most people, something alien, and that in some ways I looked at it as a ticket out of lower middle class, working class America.
You know, it seems to me you really wanted to get out of the working class, but you've never particularly wanted to be an upstanding member of the middle class.
Well, that's quite true. It's sort of that's always been a conflict in my life. Maybe I'm just afraid of the work that comes with the blue collar class, because you're right. I have never wanted to be what you would call a typical yuppie. There's many names for it, and I'm not today. You know, one of my earlier novels was dealing with just that issue, the influx of people, educated people who are paving over the tobacco fields and the forest and building subdivisions. I'm not a part of that. I'm currently actually backpedaling from that way of life. I live in Chapel Hill. I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which, you know, in itself is a very insulated liberal town. And I'm in the process of building out of my property outside of town and moving back towards a much simpler life that is much more linked to my childhood and agriculture and animals and things that were important to me growing up. I want to give that to my children so that they will have a side of life that is not just computers and videos and the pleasures of upper middle class life, but that they can see, you know, that the food in a grocery store comes from a garden. It's grown by people by who use their hands. It's not sealed in cellophane when it comes out of the earth.
Tim McLaurin, his latest book is the novel Cured by Fire. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton has recognized Vietnam. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll have a report from the White House, Terry, on what the president said. And we will also hear from visitors to the wall, the war memorial here in Washington. We'll talk to a businessman who is eager to do business in Vietnam about his view of what has happened today. The other big story that we're covering is Srebrenica, a safe area in Bosnia, which has been overrun by Serbs. The citizens of Srebrenica have apparently left the city. NATO bombers, U.S. and Dutch bombers, have fired on that area, and we're covering that, too.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A new live album from soul singer Solomon Burke is the occasion for critic Milo Miles to pay tribute to Burke's endurance and range. Milo says that Burke may not have hits in the future, but he grows more regal all the time.
Everybody, everybody, everybody. Everybody, everybody, everybody. Everybody, everybody, everybody. Clap your hands just a little. You keep hurting me, treating me like a fool. Girl, you keep hurting me, treating me like a fool. You take my money, you take my loving, still you treat me cool.
When I saw that Solomon Burke had released a CD called Live at the House of Blues, I was very skeptical. Hadn't he released a concert album 10 years ago, the plainly definitive Soul Alive? Since the opening medley of tunes was nearly the same on both records, Live at the House of Blues looked like mere flailing to cover up a lack of new material. Well, was I wrong. The new album can stand right next to the old one. But then, people have been selling Solomon Burke short for 30 years.
When your baby leaves you all alone, and nobody calls you on the phone, don't you feel like a cry? Don't you feel like a cry? Well, here I am, honey. Come on, you cry to me. When you're all alone.
Burke was born in Philadelphia in 1936 and was a child prodigy in the church. He traveled the gospel circuit as the Wonder Boy preacher when he was less than 10 years old. He helped shape the start of soul on Atlantic Records with crossover numbers like Got to Get You Off My Mind, Tonight's the Night, and Cry to Me. He was a crucial influence on Mick Jagger, who is basically Solomon Burke plus Don Covey plus British irony. But Burke's hits came early in the 60s, before the hot years of Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett, and I wonder if he wasn't too much of an old-fashioned preacher showman for the white hipsters. This was a crowd obsessed with authenticity, and they look down on things like hawking your own brand of popcorn along with your brand of secular salvation.
Someway, you realize that you've been blind. Yes, darling, you're gonna need me again.
just a matter of time. Go on, go on,
go on,
until you reach the end of your line. Just a matter of time. After I gave you
Home in Your Heart is the title of a fine double CD collection of Burke's Atlantic sides. His variety of styles and overall moderation gives him a wide range of moods. You might just put him on more regularly than, say, the volcanic Mr. Pickett. Burke stopped trying to be modern as the disco years wore on and concentrated on his road show.
Down in the valley's so low, honey, hang your head on. People hear the wind blow. Can't you hear the wind blow? Honey, hear the wind blow. Let's go down in the valley. Down in the valley so low. Have you ever been lonely?
The new Live at the House of Blues set was recorded in New Orleans, where the pickup bands are the best in the land. So Burke's accompaniment is fuller, crisper, and earns its solo space with far more hot licks than the players on the old Soul Alive set. But the Washington, D.C. crowd on that album is plugged into the same socket as Burke, and their responsive participation is as crucial as the sharp playing is on the new record. The tip-off to the tone of the collections is in their respective finales. Soul Alive ends with a medley of Sam Cooke's Having a Party and Amen. The performance is deep sermonized. Live at the House of Blues finishes with Roy Brown's Good Rockin' Tonight. This is a kickin' set geared to the crowd that hears blues as a brand of party music. Burke's voice has roughened over the last decade, given in to more bluster, but his extemporaneous sex preaching from the stage is undimmed. His plea to respect women and kiss them all over is charming, lewd, and decidedly the work of a soul veteran who is not yet bored with flirting. Just as a minister gets sermon after sermon out of the same scripture, King Solomon Burke has no trouble seeing the word made flesh.
Milo Miles is a writer living in Cambridge. Solomon Burke's recording Home in Your Heart is on Rhino, Soul Alive is on Rounder, and Live at the House of Blues is on Blacktop Records.
I'm telling you.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Say I want a little girl called my own. She must be someone.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time, the new book from Gail Sheehy, author of Passages. This is NPR, National Public Radio.